Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about how the people outside of the billionaire and millionaire class, you know, most of us, engage the economy. How many of you work 40 hours a week? How many of you work more than 40 hours a week? How about 50, even 60 hours a week? Not unknown, a lot of folks put in big hours just to put food on the table. If you're a salaried worker, guess what? Your employer is pretty happy. After all, they're getting free work. That's right. Millions of salaried workers are essentially working for free once they pass 40 hours during their work week. That's because over the past 35 years, we failed to meaningfully update our overtime pay regulations. In an earlier episode, I talked about Frances Perkins and how she was one of the main architects of the New Deal. Overtime pay was part of that. In 1938, if you made a salary less than $1,500 a year, you got paid time and a half whenever you worked more than 40 hours. That's called the overtime pay salary threshold. And as wages and the cost of living have increased, the threshold increased too. At least that was what's supposed to happen, but didn't really happen, at least not recently. The threshold was raised several times over the years and eventually increased to $13,000 in 1975. But it was another 30 years before it was raised again. In fact, starting in 1990, the overtime pay threshold was below the poverty level for a family of four. Because we failed to increase the threshold, slowly but surely, overtime pay helped fewer and fewer people. At its peak, 62% of workers were eligible for overtime pay. Today, it's only about 7%. Luckily, we have a president, President Obama, and Secretary of Labor, that's Tom Perez, and thousands of other activists and experts who recognize that the lack of overtime pay is a serious problem. In 2014, President Obama directed Tom Perez, Secretary of Labor, to update our outdated overtime regulations. The new overtime rule will raise the salary threshold for overtime eligibility from about $23,000 to just over $47,000 a year, and automatically update the salary threshold every 3 years based on wage growth. I sat down with a few experts, Judy Conte of the National Employment Law Project, Ryan Erickson of the Center for American Progress, and Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute, to talk about overtime pay and why this rule is so important for working people.
And I'm with the National Employment Law Project.
I'm Ryan Erickson, and I'm with Center for American Progress.
Ross Eisenbray with the Economic Policy Institute.
So thanks, everybody. When did overtime pay become a concept? Like, you know, when did it become a real thing? Was it because of the New Deal? How did it evolve over time?
For about 50 years or 60 years before the New Deal, the labor movement fought for an 8-hour day. First for a 10-hour day, and then eventually for an 8-hour day. But what they meant was 8 hours, and then you lay down your tools and your time is yours. The slogan was 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours for what you will. And so when Congress started in the New Deal legislating, the labor movement wasn't completely sure that they wanted something that had allowed for work beyond 8 hours in a day. With compensation, extra compensation for it. But that was really the first time that the federal government ever had overtime pay was in the New Deal. And the first bill that passed was for a 30-hour work week.
We hear a lot about how workers have been on the short end of the stick for the last 35 years, flat wages, stagnant wages, and all the same. Is overtime part of that? What's happened to overtime over the past 20 or 30 years?
Well, I think increasingly you see that people are working harder and harder than ever, and at the same time they don't see their wages going up commensurately, and like that's definitely the story of the past 20 or 30 years. Even as people work a lot more overtime, in particular focusing on the element we're going to talk about, the salary threshold for salaried workers who should be earning overtime. So, I think the salary threshold today is $23,600, essentially, and it's getting raised now with this new proposed rule. But that's not a lot of money. I think frankly, it's that effectively means that a lot of people who are working 60-hour work weeks. For taking on responsibilities that, is effectively mean they should probably be getting overtime pay.
So everybody who's hourly essentially is entitled to overtime pay. And there's no question about that. The question has been, what happens to salaried workers? A lot of people think if you're paid a salary, you don't get overtime. But in fact, the rules are that unless you're in an exempt category, unless you're a professional, an executive or an administrator, you are entitled to overtime pay, even if you're paid a salary.
And we're here talking about overtime, but it should also be made clear that when we're talking about stagnating wages, our failure to meaningfully update the minimum wage is also a huge problem. Even though we've updated it somewhat periodically, the minimum wage has consistently lost value since the 1960s. If it had just kept up with inflation, it would be close to $11 an hour. And if it kept up with productivity by various estimates, it could be anywhere from about $19 to $22 an hour. Yet it's at a paltry $7.25 right now. So that's another issue that we really need to be working on simultaneously with overtime reform.
Back in 1957, about a third of American workers were members of unions. Another third were paid as if they were. Unions had a major impact on the economic prospects of American workers. We know today union density has fallen dramatically, maybe as low as single digits in the private sector and a little bit more than that in the public sector. Has this decline in unionization contributed to the problem?
Unions are essential for raising wages for workers in the United States, but the overtime issue is a rule of regulation in the Department of Labor. And so back in the 70s, they set the level at a level that covered 60% of workers, and then it didn't get readjusted. So as inflation ate away at that amount, which let's say was $250 a week, over 40 years, inflation has been enough to make, to reduce the coverage to the point that it's almost meaningless. Only 7%, 8% of people are protected today. So the Department of Labor can fix that all by itself. Doesn't do anything for unions, and it doesn't do anything for the great mass of working people who may not even be working overtime. What unions do is raise wages for everybody by virtue of two things, that they have bargaining power, they work with a given employer. Other employers in the area react in two ways. They either say, I need to raise my wages the same way the union got for the workers at whatever company so that my people don't leave and go to work there. Mm-hmm. That's one reason. Or I need to do it so that I don't have a union. It's called the union threat. Employers will raise their wages to try to match to get close to a union wage so that they don't have a union. And in the old days when we had a third of the workforce unionized, that was a very powerful effect. It's less powerful now. And if we had the level of unions that we had back then, we estimate that the average non-union worker would have $3,000 more a year in wage or salary than he does now.
Unionized workers have their overtime rights protected. They are collectively bargained. They're part of their contracts. They have an enforcement mechanism through the union. And yet, though this is not a reform that's necessarily going to benefit current union members, the union movement and the AFL-CIO are some of the chief advocates pushing for this, showing that they're really out there. They're representing all workers, not just the ones that are in unions.
Does lack of overtime affect a certain population more than others? How does the lack of overtime impact women, for example? Or how about African Americans or Latinos? Or young people?
Yeah, the statistics will demonstrate that there are disproportionate impacts on all of the communities that you would usually figure. The ones that are most vulnerable in our workforces in general are the most vulnerable for having their overtime rights abused. The National Women's Law Center estimates that over half of the workers impacted will be women. The Economic Policy Institute has broken down every demographic that you can imagine. Ross can give more details on those.
Yeah, and the reason that women and minorities and young people are most affected by this rule is they're paid less, right? Just generally, that's the case. So the lowest salaried workers are the ones who will benefit the most from the rule, and it is disproportionately women over men, disproportionately minorities and young people.
Can you talk about the new threshold? How many workers will benefit if we can get this thing in effect?
Yeah, so basically what the new threshold does is it establishes a baseline for salaried workers. So if you are a salaried worker and you're earning less than $47,476 a year, you're guaranteed time and a half after you work 40 hours a week. And that is important because as Ross mentioned, it brings, not only does it bring a lot of clarity to, you know, whether or not you are entitled to overtime pay as a salaried worker, you know, making a certain amount of money, but also it is effectively that means you could either get more time to spend, you know, for what you will, more money to spend, basically. And that's, you know, that's an important, so that's why it's a very important protection, and like it could end up meaning that it impacts workers pretty significantly. Above that, as Ross mentioned, above that amount, you still may be eligible for overtime pay, but you know this the setting the threshold and if you make underneath that threshold, sort of ensures that anybody making under that amount of money will get overtime without bringing the exemptions into the picture.
We're talking again about executive, administrative, professional exemptions. These are not supposed to be entry-level jobs that we're talking about. So they are jobs that certainly at one point were the whole hold in the middle class, if you will. Like once you were exempt from overtime, you were in the middle class, you were starting to make it. And this is going to restore that level of benefit. So what you will see happening is people who now are working more than 40 hours a week for free. And let's be clear, when you're given a salary, when your employer considers you exempt, when you work that 41st hour, you don't get paid for that 41st hour. You're not getting even time, let alone the time and a half. So if all of a sudden people's hours are valued more, and if they have to work overtime, they're going to get time and a half for those hours. They're going to get more money. Or, as Ryan has said, and as Ross has said, they will not work those extra hours if not necessary, and they'll have more time for themselves. Or as those hours are spread out to other people, there will be workers who are perhaps sitting on the bench that get jobs. There'll be involuntary part-time workers who start to get more hours, perhaps up to full-time. So at its core, it's about making sure that people are getting overtime when they are supposed to and getting more money. But it's also going to help redistribute hours and create more jobs for people.
What kind of opposition was there? Are opponents still looking for a way out of the new overtime rule?
We have a very familiar cast of characters leading the opposition for overtime. It includes Chamber of Commerce, the National Retail Federation, and a lot of other organizations that generally argue that overtime and, say, raising the minimum wage or practically any, you know, progressive attempt to make workplaces or workplace standards better for workers or raise their wages, that it will kill jobs and that it will, you know, hurt small businesses, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we find, you know, with the overtime rule, there are particularly thin legs when they're standing on it. The for one thing, the overtime rule actually creates jobs, as Judy mentioned. You know, it creates an incentive for employers to hire extra workers because all of a sudden it becomes more affordable to businesses to hire two workers, one working at 40 hours a week, say, and another at 20, rather than paying one worker at 60 hours a week. But also it's also, you know, it's quite clearly, you know, because it doesn't kill jobs, they don't really have that line of attack. But also, I mean, I think you find that too, we're sort of restoring what's been kind of a commonly, you know, restoring a protection that's been pretty essential to, you know, the labor law in this country, like historically, that, you know, that employers may have in some cases even been taking like a little bit of an advantage of. So, I mean, I think it's important to note that, you know, the opposition is pretty much about where you would expect it, but, you know, we're also like sort of, I think, you know, in particular, we feel pretty good about the impact this is going to have on the economy, and that, you know, we believe that businesses are going to be able to take it for sure.
Yeah, we're seeing the opposition pull out everything it can, trying to block the rule, perhaps through the appropriations process. A few members of Congress have filed resolutions under the Congressional Review Act, which is a very high burden to face, because we know Obama would veto anything, and there's not enough majorities in either House to override that veto. I expect we're going to see a lawsuit as well, just, you know, to try to delay. None of this really has a leg to stand on. In terms of legal authority, the Department of Labor has a lot of discretion. And in fact, the last two times the rule was updated was under Republican administrations. And the Bush 43 administration did a far more extensive overhaul than the Obama administration is purporting to do, and they were well within their authority to do that. More importantly, in terms of the political process, this is something that is overwhelmingly popular with the American public for good reason. They know they're working longer than ever for less money than ever before. And if I could put on a different hat for a couple of moments, the National Employment Law Action Fund recently did some polling just a couple of weeks ago in 7 Senate swing states. And by margins of 76% to 81%, the people polled favored the new overtime regulations. And by margins of more than 2-1, opposition to the overtime regulation made people less likely to vote for those who are opposing the regulations. So this is common sense reform. The American public gets it. The legal challenges are without merit and are akin to a nuisance to try to delay the inevitable. And we have confidence that the political process will take care of itself.
What are some other issues working people should be aware of? Scheduling, fair scheduling, sick leave, maternity leave. How can we achieve a truly working class prosperity economy?
Well, today we found out that there has been a slight improvement in the wage gap, that now women earn 80 cents for every dollar that men earn. But that still obviously isn't good enough, which is why it is more important than ever to support laws that require employers to be more transparent about what they are paying their employees, and also require more robust action against those employers if you're able to prove that men and women aren't earning the same amount for doing equal work. Certainly also there are a number of other issues, and you hit a number of them too. Fair scheduling practices are incredibly important for workers across a variety of sectors. I've done a little bit of work researching the retail sector, and there is, you know, like in general, a lot of employers offer the scheduling, you know, practices that best benefit them and not necessarily their workers. And sometimes that results in cruel consequences where, you know, the people aren't able to arrange childcare for their families if they're called up for a shift on moment's notice and risk losing their job if they don't show up. So that's incredibly important as well.
Paid family leave, paid sick leave, also very important, along with raising the minimum wage. You know, really there's a whole host of reforms that all need to go hand in hand. We as a country devalue work and workers, perhaps more so than at any time in our history. And the fact is that the more the income inequality gap persists and grows, the less safe, the less healthy we are as a country. So we need to look at an agenda in its totality that pays better, that makes jobs pay better, that makes the benefits one that working families really need to be able to accommodate their caregiving needs, whether it be children or adult parents or someone else in their family, to have reliable and safe schedules, to make sure that jobs are safe as well, to better enforce our health and safety rules, and most importantly, to really robustly restore the right to unionize, which will not only benefit those workers who join unions, but as Ross aptly explained, will benefit workers across the board.
Yeah, I'd throw in one more reform that we need, and that's something to remedy wage theft, which is something that Keith Ellison has concentrated on in his own work in Congress. But there are laws that are being considered in states and localities around the country that recognize that we don't punish employers who cheat workers. Mm-hmm. We barely make them pay back what they owe when they're caught, and they're caught all too infrequently. But when they are caught, they end up paying back partially, what they owe. The only way to deter that kind of behavior is to criminalize it, to say, this is a crime. You're stealing from workers when they've put in their 8 hours or worked overtime and you don't pay them what you owe them. That should be a crime. It should be treated that way. And the economic consequences for the employers have to be made severe enough that there's a real deterrent. So triple damages, for example, is something that we have found research shows will deter employers, the threat of triple damages. That kind of public recognition that workers deserve to be paid for the work that they've done, and employers need to be punished when they don't do it, is something that we need.
Hey guys, thanks so much for coming by. Really appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The updated overtime threshold will make more than 4 million workers eligible for overtime pay. That's a big deal. That's a big deal for workers and their families and their neighborhood and everybody struggling to make it by. Unfortunately, special interests, along with their Republican friends in the U.S. House, are already working to undermine the overtime rule. Just this week, Republicans voted to delay implementation of the rule by 6 months. Thankfully, the president opposes the delay, but opponents won't stop. It's up to all of us, you and me, activists, organizers, and experts like Judy Conte, Ryan Erickson, and Ross Eisenbray to continue to oppose these efforts to undermine the updated salary threshold for overtime workers. In the wealthiest nation on earth, at the wealthiest point in its own history, the United States can certainly afford to compensate workers fairly. That means having a livable minimum wage, but it also means guaranteeing paid leave. And it certainly means ensuring that people who work long hours are properly paid and given their overtime. For this episode of We the Podcast, this is Keith Ellison, and I will see you next time. Do me a favor and head on over to We the Podcast page on iTunes and rate, review, and subscribe. This episode of We the Podcast was produced by Maria Lavadier, Carol Wayman, and Brett Morrow.